shatters the frown of the nations in the thoughts of their hearts. God takes the powerful from their thrones and lifts up the lowly. God fills the hungry with good things and sends the rich away empty.
You're listening to Faith and Reason 360. Support for this program comes from the Joe and Louise Cook Foundation, Barbara Winland Director, and the D.L. Deitch Jr. Foundation, promoting critical thinking and advocating for justice in our world. I'm Debo Dykes.
And I'm Ann Phelps.
And Ann, welcome back. I know you are the greatest and happiest mom in the world.
Oh, goodness. That's not a high bar to live up to at all.
So Abigail and William are doing well.
They're doing well, keeping me entertained as always. We had a little power outage this week because of the hurricane-related weather, and William just thought that was the most fun thing he'd ever done.
Oh,
so
I
we're
bet
doing
he
great.
Did. Oh, wow, that little adventurous boy. Anyway, also with us today is David Dykes.
I'm glad to be here. Hello, Ann. Hello, Debo. And hello, Jorg Rieger.
Yes. Hello, Jorg. We have a very special guest today. Jorg Rieger, we're going to be doing another series for you that could possibly catch you off guard and yet find you cannot stop listening. With us is Dr. Jorg Rieger, Distinguished Professor of Theology and Cal Turner Chancellor's Chair. Ooh, that's a lot of C's. In Wesleyan Studies in the Divinity School and Graduate Department of Religion at Vanderbilt University. He is also director of newly founded program in Religion and Justice at Vanderbilt Divinity School.
Jorg was born and raised in Mürhardt, Germany, which Debo is making me say because I lived briefly in Germany and can pretend like I still speak German.
I thought that was excellent.
Say it again. But we are thrilled to have you with us today, Jorg.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yes, and Jorg has authored and edited 22 books, and some of them have been translated into 6 different languages. So for our listeners all over the place, you may or may not be able to find them in the language that you speak first. So that is good news.
Really good. Mm-hmm. This series of Faith and Reason 360 podcast include 5 episodes featuring Dr. Rieger's latest book, Jesus versus Caesar, for people tired of serving the wrong God. And you're so good at this, and I can tell you are eager to ask your questions.
Well, thank you.
So let's go for it.
Love it. Well, yes, I am so excited about this book. I had such a good time reading it and just diving into this content. It's so relevant for what's going on in our world today. We see so many tensions. I don't think that I even have to look very hard to find constant conflict around us at all times. Right now, we can think as we're listening to some Supreme Court hearings about the tension between Republicans and Democrats. We think about the tension between conservatives and liberals. We think about the tension between Christianity and atheism or religions within religions. In your book, Jesus versus Caesar, you identify a prime tension within Christianity. How would you explain and name that tension?
I think this is the big challenge that is before us. How do we think about the tensions of our day and what's really at stake? And so in this book, I'm actually saying that the tension is between Christians and other Christians. So the tension is not, as most people would think, you know, between Christianity and paganism, between Christianity and atheism, but it is within Christianity itself. And here the problem is that you have a dominant Christianity that goes along with the powers that be, mm-hmm. and then you have some alternatives. So the interesting question is, what are these alternatives? And of course also, what is this dominant Christianity up to and what's wrong with it?
Right, right. So in your book, you identify it's so easy for us to start in the here and now, and to identify some dominant Christianities now and some of the conflicts around us. But you do the harder work of looking back a long time ago, thousands of years, what was going on in the Roman Empire? What did that tension look like when the character of Jesus, that central figure in Christianity, entered the scene?
So if you take it back, this is now almost 2,000 years, you have to realize that in the Roman Empire, you have a pluralistic context. Mm-hmm. The Romans, of course, were all over the world. They were dealing with all kinds of religions. And the Romans were not religiously narrow-minded. They were religiously tolerant. They could actually incorporate other religions into their own theology, into their own empire. But they couldn't quite incorporate Christianity. And that's sort of the thing that we're trying to figure out. Why was it? What was the Romans' problem with Christianity? They had no problem with the Egyptians. You know, they had Isis and Osiris. Mm-hmm. They had the old Greek gods. Mm-hmm. But they could not deal with Jesus and the Christian God.
And they even, I mean, in certain ways, honored Judaism at times, right? I mean, they had these sort of kings that they put in place, Herod and these leaders. They were willing to tolerate some very different religious views, but they had no tolerance for Jesus to the point of needing to put him to death. What was at the root of that conflict? Why was Jesus such a difficult figure for the Romans?
Well, my argument is to say that there was a basic assumption of what it means to believe in God and what it means to have a God. Mm-hmm. And so for them, you know, the idea of God, I sometimes call this theism, is this idea that God's always at the top. Mm-hmm. God's sort of imagined, envisioned in terms of the Roman emperor. Mm-hmm. So you have somebody who's not only at the top, but whose power is exercised from the top, who rules from the top down, who is in control of things, who has certain markers of dominance, power, and wealth. And none of this you find in Jesus. So the tension is right there that Jesus, especially envisioning Jesus as a God, doesn't quite fit in any of this theology.
It's interesting you bring up that you call it theism. In your book, you talk a little bit about the relationship between Christianity and theism, or Christianity and atheism. Can you say more about that relationship? What did atheism look like in this context?
So what I pick up in the book is an old Roman charge against Christianity. This is what some of the philosophers actually put in writing. They charged Christians with being atheists. So this was a Roman accusation. And by that, they basically meant your God does not look like a real God because he doesn't have the top-down power. He doesn't have all these trappings. And keep in mind, for the Romans to proclaim a human being as God was not a problem. Right. That was a problem for Jewish religion. They could not have seen a human being in the place of God. The Romans were just fine seeing human beings as gods, like some of the emperors were declared God. So their problem with Jesus wasn't that he was a human being. Their problem was that he did not match these images of the emperor. And so for that reason, the Romans actually accused the Christians of being atheists.
It's interesting that you raise that point, kind of bringing it back to today. It is not uncommon to hear certain iterations of theism that identify themselves as Christianity, as most religion does in this country, call other Christians atheists for similar reasons today, which has definitely been a complaint lodged at myself at times. but it's true. It has been now 2,000 years that's been used as a highly critical idea.
I want to ask York, Dr. Rieger, I want to ask, how quickly did the Romans see what he was up to? Was it at the end of his life? Were they watching him all along, do you think?
Well, that's an interesting question. Maybe the historians could find some answer. It's always difficult to know exactly what happened in those days because we don't have all the historical records. But it seems to me what the Romans became aware of was that Jesus was not just a typical radical preacher. There were a lot of these radical preachers around. He wasn't the only one. They realized that he was also organizing people, building power, that he sort of was building something that was bigger than just a small, you know, irrelevant religious following. And so I would suggest that this sort of thing became a problem from the very beginning. There is a passage early on in the Gospel of Mark where it mentioned that after a healing, after a certain healing, the Pharisees and the Herodians were conspiring to get rid of Jesus. So this wasn't like everybody thought he was a really good guy for, you know, a couple of years and then they wanted to get rid of him. But some of his contemporaries, and I think that includes the Romans, early on realized that there was something that was difficult and something that was dangerous about it. And that goes back to the charge of atheism. Mm-hmm. So here the problem with atheism is not just, we don't agree with you, but we think this is really dangerous. This is something that's different from, you know, the way normal religion and normal society functions. But here's the important thing not to forget. This is the sort of thing that the early Christians actually appreciated and bore with pride. So for them, atheism wasn't sort of this is a horrible charge and we now have to argue against it. In some degrees, this was the sort of thing that made them proud. They said, maybe we're actually getting
because they weren't buying Caesar as God.
Exactly.
That was not the Lord. So they worshipped or followed, I should say, a different.
Jörg, I want to come back to actually how you begin chapter one. You say, failure to understand the tension between life-giving and malignant religion has not only done damage to millions of people and to the earth, but it has also caused millions more to abandon religion altogether. Go ahead, Anne.
I think that's a really important point to raise up. You know, we've talked a little bit about the context in which Jesus was operating and the powers that be that opposed him. And it raises the question, why? What was the content of his ministry, the content of his message that made him such a dangerous figure for these authorities?
So I think this is the question, what is behind this tension between theism and atheism? You could say, maybe it's just a religious, a philosophical disagreement. But what's behind it, as far as I can see, is really a different way of looking at the world. So it's a different way of understanding how power flows, who loses, who wins, and so on. And what Jesus saw, I think this is pretty clear, was that in this Roman theist system, a lot of people were suffering. This mm-hmm. was not working for the basic communities. This was not working in the villages where he mm-hmm. grew up. This was not working for a lot of people who were not on the powerful end of the empire.
Mm-hmm. So you're referencing that inequality was a big problem, right? This was working for some of the people at the top, but not for the people at the bottom. And what I draw from your interpretation of Jesus's ministry that resonates with my reading of the gospel as well is that Jesus didn't come and propose an alternative to Caesar to sort of play alongside Caesar and say, and now let's add another god to the mix, but wanted to completely turn society on its head, completely, blessed are the poor, focus on the least of these, absolutely upend what was in the structure in place at the time.
And I think this is what made him so dangerous. Mm-hmm. This is what made him so challenging. This is why they eventually wanted to get rid of him. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of other radical preachers that, got in conflict with the Roman Empire, but that were not killed. Mm-hmm. And so in Jesus' case, it was precisely that, for him to see that there was not only something wrong with the empire, but there was something else, some other values that were out there that he stood for. So that's the basic tension that we're seeing. And if you look at this today, I think this is the big question before us now, except that, the old Caesar religion is no longer active. Some of Christianity has taken its place. So that's where we're today.
Yeah. I'll be excited to explore in this series a little bit more about how that came about, that Christianity came to absorb some of those characteristics that were true of the religion of Caesar, the religion of the empire, and don't really sound much like the content that Jesus was preaching, yet that's kind of the version of Christianity that I think a lot of us encounter today. I love.
And this is, of course, the reason. Excuse me for interrupting you. This is the reason why a lot of people have lost faith in Christianity. Mm-hmm. What I find a lot is people are leaving churches. People are sort of leaving Christianity behind, not because they lost faith in God, right, but because they lost faith in the church, and because the church has oftentimes been on the wrong side of things. This goes back to the quote that Debo read earlier, where we're talking about this tension between, on the one hand, malignant religion, mm-hmm, and then life-giving religions. Also, the problem with this empire religion is not only that it may be following a false religious and philosophical model, but that it actually ends up hurting people, mm-hmm, it ends up costing lives, it ends up killing people. And when we say that, we then have to say, what is the alternative? And that's what excites me about the project, not so much, mm-hmm, just criticizing, mm-hmm, what went wrong, yeah, but saying what's going right.
Well, and we have a growing young adult audience to our podcast. And you mentioned in your book that you speak about especially young adults. They're worried about the increasingly hostile and destructive nature of Christianity that simply goes with the dominant culture's flow. Of course, I'm quoting you in your book. Mm-hmm. And obvious and even callous in the face of others' suffering. Yeah, I'd like you to speak to that, because that's so obvious to so many of us now that are all awake and aware. There's so much suffering that's going on all over the world, and our young people seem to be more in tune with that and more responsive to that than I remember generations in the past being.
I think that there's something about young people who oftentimes are more attentive to what's happening around them. Maybe children, you know, picking up things in more unfiltered fashion. And then, of course, adult society moving in and telling them, well, maybe it's not that important, you shouldn't worry about it. But today, I think especially, you find young people in this country bearing the brunt of a lot of what's going wrong. So we talk about unemployment numbers going down at this moment, but we're not talking about the fact that jobs are getting worse and worse. Mm-hmm. Conditions of jobs are getting worse and worse. Benefits are no longer available in many places. And it's the young people who are experiencing that in their own bodies. It's the young people that graduate from college and may find a job, but not the job that they prepared for. Mm-hmm. It's young people that actually see a lot of the struggles. For some reason, they have this compassion to maybe get a little better sense of what's going on with racism, you know, what is really happening here from all sides. I see this with some of my students. They get into this. They get involved in movements. And when they don't see the churches there, guess what? They're not coming back. And why would they?
Absolutely. Well, what it seems like it's become is that the people that give lip service publicly who use this, if we adhere to the dogmatic statements about religion or about Jesus, about Christ, that seems to satisfy them. But they get angry if you translate that in any way that is a challenge to the status quo. Then that's when they say, you're an atheist, or you're not a true believer, or you're Satan, is when you don't reinforce what the status quo wants to be reinforced.
I think that's true. And the interesting thing for me as a theologian, if you take this back to some of the doctrinal statements and the dogmas of the church, there is some real dynamite there that we're not exploring. And so even the people that want to go back to the old traditions oftentimes overlook that they have something in their hands that would actually help us in this time. So we could talk about the Nicene Creed later, which a lot of people think is just an empire creed. And I'm arguing there's something there that could be very much part of what people are looking for. It's just
like
the
what?
Churches are not missing
like
it.
What?
Well, I found it fascinating what you talk about in the book with the Nicene Creed and how the creeds function generally. I mean, I had never thought of the fact that the Council of Nicaea, right, meets in the 4th century, and all these church leaders come together to hash out, you know, what do we formally believe as a cohesive church? Well, somebody had to fund that. And who funded that? Constantine, right? Who funded that was the person that was now the head of the Church of the Empire and has taken Christianity and turned it on its head. And, you know, that as a young person who is sort of in this conflict that we find ourselves in, that really resonated with me because it rang so true to my experience of church. I've told the story to Devo before, but I make the joke that it was 2 years ago that I gave up church for Lent. And the reason I
remember this.
Yes, was because the church was making it too hard to follow Jesus. And you drew this great delineation a moment ago about, the church is what's turning people off, not the message of Jesus, right? The message of Jesus was very physical and tangible and rooted in life in this world. Feed the hungry, first and foremost. Second, educate the masses, heal the sick. These very practical, tangible things that we as young people don't see the church doing. But we do hear the church reciting the creed. The creed that was endorsed and funded by Constantine, and the creed that doesn't mention for one second the content of Jesus's ministry.
Can we go back to that funding notion about Constantine? Let's talk about what that meant. What that meant was travel, and what that meant was transportation, and what that meant was meals and lodging, entertainment. You can bet politics behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. Is it true that the night before the opening of the conference, was it Athanasius, people who were in the streets with torches, chanting "There was when he was not"? Isn't that part of the folklore of the council there? That doesn't ring a bell.
I don't know that.
I'm not quite sure about that part of the history. Yes.
Well, when I was in school, way back, that was one of the little anecdotes about the atmosphere that was occurring at the conference. Was that there was this tremendous political back and forth. Of course, it was about theology, but it was politics too. And when you say that Constantine funded this conference, that means a lot of people got to take a trip, stay in the hotel, and do the whole thing. So it wasn't just to have the conference. It was to organize a political solution to something Constantine was trying to deal with.
Which, David, say a little bit more, that was it, there was when he was not. Didn't that have to do with the substance of God, Jesus being of the substance of God?
Yeah, and that's probably something we can talk about at another time. I don't want to spend much time on it, but I meant to say that only because it was a very exciting and high-tension-filled event.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was at stake. It's not just that they were hashing out some theological issues. At stake was ultimately the unity of the empire. And so this is part of the earlier question that Anne raised about, you know, how did Christianity become an empire religion? It took a few centuries. It didn't happen right away. And then Constantine, of course, that was one of the big steps. This is now the 4th century Common Era. And Constantine sort of is now the sole emperor. It took a while for him to get there also. Sole emperor of the Roman Empire. And he has this interest of unifying the Roman Empire. And so there were warring factions that had different ideas. And the one that you just mentioned, those were people that rejected sort of the eternal nature of Jesus as the second person of the Trinity. What finally came out of the Council of Nicaea was this understanding that Jesus is of the same substance as God, the second person of the Trinity. Now, that's all technical, theological language, but this is where the interesting moment comes in. So let me say maybe a few words about that. So once that was decided that Jesus was the second person of the Trinity, in other words, fully God, and then later on in another council, they decided he was both fully God and fully human. But at that point, the big thing was Jesus was actually like God. Now, what Constantine might have intended, of course nobody exactly knows because we do not have his diary or his journal, what Constantine might have intended was to domesticate Jesus, to shape Jesus in the image of the first person of the Trinity that was oftentimes defined according to the nature of the emperor. Again, top-down, omnipotent, omniscient, you know, always in control. And so if you declare Jesus as of the same substance with that God. Now you can get rid of all the radical Jesus stories and all the ministry stories.
Rather than elevating his message, you neutralize him and silence him and sort of absorb him into that empire God.
And that's exactly what happened to some degree. So in that regard, you can say that the Nicene Creed, the point of that was that it looked like it was unifying the Roman emperor, that he was asserting the power of the emperor, that he was domesticating Jesus. By the way, Constantine not only paid for the travel and the entertainment of the bishops, he also presided over the council. And this term of the same substance, Jesus of the same substance as God, came from Constantine. So all of that goes together, shows you the interests of the emperor. Now, what I'm saying is you can turn this around, and all of a sudden the Nicene Creed reads like a very radical proposition. So that is what interests me, rather than saying, well, it was just an empire creed. Right. What's the alternative?
Right. I love how, you know, I've read a number of books, particularly on ecclesiology, more about church history and church identity questions, that structure their book on the creeds, right? They use the creeds as the sort of thematic structure for their writing. You don't do that here. I love that what you actually use in this book as the guiding text that to structure your thoughts on is the Lord's Prayer. Can you say a little bit about why you chose that particular text?
Yeah, that's really good. Go.
If you go through the Lord's Prayer, it's really more a radical manifesto than a little spiritual statement, the way we usually think about it, because it talks about God's kingdom coming. Talks about relationships with God. It talks about forgiveness of debt. It talks about daily bread. It talks about the hope that Christians have, and that sort of thing. You know, if you read that in this broad context in which it was said, keep in mind that for the ancients, questions of religion, politics, and economics were not separate. Those were sort of very closely related. Mm-hmm. And once you start looking at it that way, all of a sudden you see that there is something that's extremely powerful. And as far as the Nicene Creed goes, if you plug that back into the Nicene Creed, all of a sudden that creed becomes a lot more interesting. But this is how I work. You start with these ancient resources. Mm-hmm. You rethink the creeds and the traditions of the church from that perspective. And all of a sudden, everything looks different. So you're getting less of the empire Christianity and more of the alternative.
Yeah, God from God becomes a lot more powerful when it means this God of this place, this stuff of life and food and education. And those phrases get infused with meaning rather than just deconstructing them.
So what happens here now, and you know, one more time back to the Nicene Creed, is once you put God and Jesus on the same level and you read this backwards and you say Jesus is actually defining who we think God is, then the whole thing changes. Then it's no longer you predetermine who God is in terms of an ancient empire theism, but you're now rethinking God from the life, the ministry, the death and the resurrection of Jesus. Right. And once you do that, all of a sudden your images of God change. This is why I'm actually very interested in thinking about the implications of Jesus, not just for social action and revolution, but really for how we think about God, how we are people of faith, rethinking religion from that end.
Yeah, if God is no longer a king on a throne, but an orphan born on the margins of society and a refugee, then what we value has changed.
In your book, I love this statement where you say, the God of Caesar is not compatible with the God of Jesus.
The assumption is, of course, that whenever you talk about God, you're talking about the same thing. And this is one of the big points in my book. I'm saying that is not the case. So when people say God, the real question is, what God are you talking about? And you have to realize that there are different images of God that are not compatible. So this is now the question back to the churches. I'm not happy to leave it with churches saying, well, we believe in God. I want to know what God you're believing in. And of course, for Christians, I always ask the question, does this God have anything to do with this Jesus Christ that we're now here starting to describe, who was born, you know, in a very difficult situation, became a refugee, but also was a working person? I mean, Jesus ultimately was the sort of person that's much more like the common people today rather than the emperors and the leaders.
I know we're getting close to time, but I do want to mention this one more thing. And, York, I'm going to read from your book, and then I would like for you to comment. You say, the justice for which Jesus stands means that God is taking the side of those who are in need of grace in situations of pressure and need, the ones who have no illusions about their ability to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps. Quickly, I'd like for you to comment on that.
This is another example of what we're talking about in the book, the justice of Jesus versus the justice of Caesar. And keep in mind, the justice of Caesar is not always a bad one. So this is not to knock down the justice of the empire, but the justice of the empire in the old images of Lady Justice, you know, statues that you may remember, it has a blindfold, holds scales and a sword, basically identifying neutrality. So so justice here is something that stands above the world, looks down and tries to figure out neutrally what's going on. In Jesus's ministry, which is really drawing a lot from the Hebrew prophets and from many of the Jewish traditions, justice does not mean neutrality. It means taking sides. It means putting yourself on the side of the victims in order to bring good news to the poor. This is what Jesus says several times, Gospel of Matthew, Gospel of Luke. What's the ministry, you know, to bring good news to the poor, proclaim relief to the oppressed? Those kinds of things are at the heart of this new kind of justice. And from there, of course, then the community is restored. So this is a very active, participatory way of justice that includes compassion, that includes really changing things, realizing that the situation as it is now is not right.
I think that's a really powerful articulation of justice, that justice is not blind. And you say clearly in your book, and I hear you saying it again now, that to be blind and try and enact justice is to just uphold the status quo, is to just perpetuate what is already happening. And the justice that Jesus espouses is one that intervenes on behalf of the marginalized, which I think is a really powerful message to carry with us in these times.
Well, and with that, we're going to leave our listening audience hungry for our next episode that, again, will feature Dr. York Rieger. And David, thank you also for being here.
Yes.
And our Faith and Reason 360 podcasts are free to all listeners. However, if you're interested in supporting our podcast with a small donation, please visit our website at faithandreason.org. There's no such thing as a small donation, so if you would like to donate $1 or $5 or $50, it's a tax-free gift. So please visit our website again at faithandreason.org. That is faithandreason.org. And one more thing, if you're interested in purchasing Dr. York Rieger's book, it is available online at Amazon. Is that correct, Dr. Rieger?
Yes, that's correct. Amazon.
Excellent.
And all the other booksellers, Barnes & Noble, and you name them.
Great. Well, and again, you need to look for, if you go to Amazon or any of the other bookstores, if you look for Jesus versus Caesar by York Rieger, and I'm going to spell that, it's J-O-E-R-G-R-I-E-G-E-R. I got that right.
That's good, yes.
All right.
This program is produced by Faith and Reason, a program of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation.
God chose Israel, remembering mercy, according to the promise to those he made before, to Sarah, to Abraham, to Hagar, to their children's children.